In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints. We now go to the West Bank, the occupied West Bank of Palestine, where we're joined by our correspondent, Anne Gwynn, who's been watching the situation deteriorate for the last 6 months. And we have heard a lot, Anne, about the killing of 4 or 5 occupation soldiers in Gaza. The Israelis have used these killings as an excuse, they say, to once again occupy neighborhoods across the West Bank and in Gaza. They said that up until the shooting, they were relaxing regulations. They were letting people come and go. They were relieving the curfew. What is your experience in terms of the situation?
Well, the situation is much more severe. The lockdown is much more severe now than it was even 2 weeks ago. We've been under, Nablus has been under lockdown, the whole curfew, the whole time I've been here. But for the last 2 months, it's gradually got worse, and the soldiers use words like, Nablus is under complete lockdown, so go back to Jerusalem, even though you say I live in Nablus. Every checkpoint is full of long lines of hundreds of people. The women are often able to get through, but the men rarely. There are long lines of blindfolded, handcuffed students coming back from other universities because their semesters have ended. Long lines of people going to the hospitals because Nablus is, of course, a regional center for everything. It's got 6 very, very well-known hospitals. They've started arresting women at the checkpoints. This is a new departure at the checkpoints, actually. But at Beit Iba yesterday, which is a very notorious checkpoint on the north road to Jenin, Nazareth, and Syria, they arrested 3 young schoolgirls aged about 17. They held them for 6. They held them for 6 hours. Then when the ambulance driven by my friend Firas arrived, they were just being arrested. Their mobile phones were just being thrown to the ground, stamped on by the soldiers, and ruined. And they asked Firas to tell their mothers that they had been arrested because they were not allowed a phone call. I mean, these are things which have not happened before. Girls haven't. There were no women soldiers on the checkpoint, by the way, so they were searched intimately by men. The soldiers were Ethiopian and Russian. There were no Jewish soldiers on that checkpoint. And we do find here, I have to say this, that the Ethiopian and the Russians and other nationalities are far, far worse even than the ordinary Israeli soldiers, really. So as far as easing the situation is concerned, no one can go anywhere. Ambulances, even this is the first time this has happened, ambulances are not allowed through the checkpoints at all unless a teenage soldier decides that it's an emergency. And he simply asks, where are you going, why? They tell him and he says, oh, emergency, it's not emergency, go home and wait.
I understand there was an ambulance stolen yesterday.
Yesterday, an ambulance of a charity, a European charity in Nablus, was stolen on the Nablus to Jenin Road. It's about 30 kilometers. It was driven by Mohammed Jamal Sakhti, a very well-known ambulance driver in Nablus, and the sick patient, Alam Massad, a well-known Jenin family. They were both arrested. We don't know why. We don't know where they are. And the ambulance was driven away. I know they use the attack on the soldiers in Gaza as an excuse for this. This has not stopped. It's been intensifying over the past 2 weeks particularly, but over the past month. This attack was just really using it. They just used it as a pretext. Nothing was ever opened here. Never.
We're speaking with Anne Gwynn in Nablus. She is our special correspondent. I'm looking at the report that just came out from the Palestinian Center for Human Rights. This is before the attack on the soldiers. 6 Palestinians were killed last week, including a child. There was an assassination. There were at least 17 houses demolished. Many acres of land were destroyed with fruit groves by the Israelis. And tens, if not hundreds of people were arrested last week. Does that comport with what you're seeing on the ground?
Hundreds, Dennis, really hundreds of people, even here. It's absolutely unbelievable. I think I told you this. 67 people were injured, children here, in 2 days, Tuesday and Wednesday last week. That's an awful lot of deliberate shooting because there is no accident about this. None at all. They shoot at the boys throwing stones. It's not an accident. 12 of them are very seriously injured. Injuries like, I went to the hospital, they lose an eye, they lose a forearm, they lose a foot because the bullet is, the cannon is large, I've forgotten what it's called now. now on the gun. It's 25 millimetres and it smashes a child's bone. One child has a bone in the bullet in the temple. They don't know whether they can remove it. One's lost an eye, an arm, a foot. One has a very serious shoulder injury because these huge bullets do, they actually smash a child's shoulder. It's not just a bullet wound as we think of it from a handgun. It's very, very major. The blood loss is terrible.
Well, none of this was reported last week. Now, let's talk a little bit about the shooting of the Israeli soldiers. Now, these were, I'm sure, first of all, it's a tragedy because, again, more young men, these are Israelis, but more young people are dying because of this brutal occupation. These soldiers were carrying forward the occupation. They were fully armed on Palestinian land that was illegally occupied. One can only imagine, one hopes that these weren't the soldiers that shot down Rachel Corrie or Tom Herndell, or the soldiers that were shooting at kids that Tom Herndell was trying to save before he was shot. But I know that Hamas and the other groups, three groups, claimed responsibility for this shooting. And I know, Anne, that you were speaking with Hamas leaders. So help us understand what's going on behind the scenes as people talk about peace on the surface.
You know, it's such an involved and complicated situation here. I mean, the peace process, you know, its number one condition is that Palestinians shall stop the violence. Palestinians, are they saying that the killing of 3,400 or 3,500 people in less than 3 years, Palestinian people, 60% of them under 17, is this not violence? I mean, why Palestinians stop the violence? They also demand, in tandem with that, the disarming of Hamas, Al-Aqsa Shahada Brigade, and Al-Jihad Islami, who are all legitimate freedom fighters, resistance fighters. Actually, the UN even passed a resolution saying that on Palestine particularly, not just an international general rule, that Palestinians had the right to resist the illegal occupation with whatever force was deemed necessary, including the use of weapons. I mean, I think this is a factor so generally forgotten because they have become called gunmen. In a situation where you're living in your own land and you're illegally occupied by the fourth largest military in the world, I really don't think the gunmen can be applied to Palestinian. I mean, it has to be applied to the illegal gunmen. I mean, this is how I see it. And Hamas has five basic conditions which are totally sensible and without which, you know, they will not enter into any peace negotiations or disarming negotiations. One is the occupation must stop. Israeli soldiers must withdraw behind the 67 borders. Everyone here recognizes the 67 borders. Again, it's a paradox. Okay, Palestine recognizes the 67 borders of Israel, that Israel is de facto there, a state, but Israel does not recognize Palestine with the 67 borders. It's still killing people every day. Number two is that the refugees' right of return is inviolable and it cannot be, non-negotiable, because their land was illegally taken from them by force at a moment's notice. Their villages were razed and they were herded out of the illegally constituted state of Israel, which we all recognize as being there now, so it's fine. They're all here in refugee camps. I believe there's some 5 million of them. Now, this right of return, I'm sure you know this, but I guess many of the listeners don't. It's not that 5 million people would return to Israel, which is what Israel tries to say. They use this number, rather like Europe says, if we open our borders, 35 million refugees will land in Europe. No, they won't. This is just a principle, because if the principle is allowed and recognized, well, it is allowed under international law, but if Israel recognizes it, it will pave the way for compensation. And when people have lost everything, and they have lived for four generations in Balata and other refugee camps, compensation for what they have lost must surely be the minimum they can accept. The third thing is that East Jerusalem, Al-Quds, is the capital of a reduced Palestine, a Palestine reduced even behind the 67 borders to 22% of its original size. That's not negotiable. Israel says that Jerusalem is Jewish, Israeli, and it cannot be the capital of Palestine. That's a third. The fourth thing is that the political prisoners, who are some between 12 and 14,000, we don't know exactly, because with many prisoners, they disappear and we don't know where they are. But it's between 12 and 14,000 who are in Israeli prisons must be released, because they're in prison because they have been exercising their internationally recognized right to resist an illegal occupation. These things are completely non-negotiable. They're basic, and it's obvious, really, when you think about them, that they can't be negotiated. So Israel hasn't given one inch on any of these, not even on one of them. In fact, Prime Minister Sharon declared yesterday that no Palestinian shall ever have the right of return, even before he was supposed to say it, because President Bush said he shouldn't discuss this until the very end. But, of course, we knew this was the fact. So they haven't given an inch. They have said today they will dismantle, I think it's 14, I love the word, illegal outposts of settlement. All settlements are illegal and have been declared so by the UN, all of them. And the 14 outposts that Prime Minister Sharon says he will dismantle today are all unoccupied trailers. Not quite what it sounds. And really, when you talk to Hamas, Jihad Islami, and Al-Aqsa, you know, and Fatah, really, there is no other word for this. They say Israel is up to its tricks again.
How were you received by Hamas? Was there some suspicion, this white European coming in to meet with them? Give us a sense of the mood of the people that you met with and how you were received.
I can't tell you what a privilege and an honor it is to be able to discuss these things with the resistance, because this is the first time it has ever happened. They refuse to even look. They don't even want to be in the same city as other internationals. It's absolutely, I can't tell you what an honor and a privilege it is, and there's so much more when I come back to Oakland to tell you. Wow. Because they are very special people, these guys. I don't know why. They say it's because they know they can trust me. I have said you shouldn't trust anybody, including me. They said I don't trust anybody else, but it's in your eyes. And I really believe in the justice of the resistance, and they can see it, I guess, and it's amazing. I've been received in the houses of all the greatest fighter families in this area to sleep. I mean, it's such an honor, because this is the only way we can understand what goes on, how people operate, what makes them give their lives, because you only have one, for their country. Everywhere else in the world, people who give their lives for their country are honored. Every year in Britain, we have this massive ceremony in London, November the 11th, the war memorial ceremony. Every village and town has this ceremony. Every war memorial has inscribed upon it, "Greater love hath no man than he give his life for his friend." That's exactly what 3,500 Palestinians have done in this intifada alone. 7,000 since the beginning of the first intifada, and Allah only knows how many since the beginning, since 1948, when this major thing started. And well, all of the fighters have 100% chance of losing their lives, and we give the Victoria Cross to people who undertake an operation in defense of their friend or their land, to anyone who has a 95% chance of losing their life. The Victoria Cross is the highest award for valor in Europe. Wow, it's so different in Palestine.
We're speaking with Anne Gwynn. She's our special correspondent. Anne, we're running out of time, but why don't you just tell people, perhaps, what is the biggest lesson that you've learned since you've moved from your work as a banker, a school teacher, a grandmother, to a correspondent riding an ambulance through occupied Palestine? What have you learned? How has it changed you?
I think it's changed everything in my life, and that might be the subject of some program when I come to California. But mostly, it has changed. I really understand now that every Palestinian, even the fighters, the resistance fighters, the Mujahideen, who in their masks, they're only in masks because people, because they will be arrested if their faces are visible, are all wanting nothing but peace. They all wish to put their gun in the guest room.